and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. A quick program note, we'll be speaking with Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin at the half hour. Now, in 2014 and 2015, Hawaii ocean researchers witnessed an unprecedented level of coral bleaching. West Hawaii Island and southwestern Maui had the deepest losses. This month, the state Department of Land and Natural Resources, Division of Aquatic Resources, announced its first ever coral recovery plan. It centers on two approaches, establishing a network of permanent no-take marine protected areas and a network of herbivore fishery management areas. Dr. Bruce Anderson is the administrator of the Department of Land and Natural Resources Division of Aquatic Resources, and he joins us now by phone. Aloha. Thank you for the time.
Hi, Beth Ann. Glad to talk about this.
So how will the state establish that network of a permanent no-take marine fishing or protecting areas and also that network of fishery management areas? Where will they be?
That's certainly one of the top strategies. And actually, we're looking more at a network of marine managed areas, which would allow for some fishing activities. But the important thing is that we have a well-designed network of managed areas that work together and optimize the protection of our natural resources and also the fishery. And that's certainly a challenge. We're looking at that as a long-term project, but we also have a number of other things that we're planning in the short run that would be, I think, also effective in addressing some of the issues associated with coral bleaching. Simply putting out rules in the near future to limit or ban the taking of parrotfish, for example, would probably be the single most important thing we could do. And that doesn't take years to do. It can be done through the normal rulemaking process. Night spearing and other activities, which also are reducing the herbivore population, may also help to help our reefs to recover and make them more resilient.
But if those two key parts to this plan, as you say, take a great deal of time to develop, there are some who might be concerned that this is insufficient to be able to meet such an intense problem that is worsening so quickly.
Well, it's certainly a challenge. There's no question we're going to have new and probably more serious bleaching events in the future. Last year, 2016, wasn't as bad as 2014 and 15 when we lost over 50% of our reefs. That's a lot and a serious impact. Last year, the water was a little cooler than it was the previous 2 years. This coming year, in fact, this coming summer, they're predicting warmer temperatures again, and of course that'll translate to warmer seawater temperatures, and I'm afraid we may see some renewed bleaching in those areas you mentioned. West Hawaii, south of the leeward side of Maui, Kaneohe Bay, and North Kauai were the areas most severely impacted, and probably would again be impacted, but there's no area that isn't going to be impacted to some degree.
That's all sounding so horrible for people who have already heard that 50% of the reefs have been lost. To think about additional loss is truly unthinkable, but we all have to think about this in terms of what can be done, as you say, near-term and long-term. But what do you say to some in the research community who might feel that some of this is just sounding too passive, especially, you know, given some of the information that we heard earlier this year that the Great Barrier Reef, for example, is far more damaged than was originally thought? And here we already have these stunning statistics about our own reefs. Is there anything that's much more aggressive that might be brought into play more immediately?
Actually, Hawaii has, I think, led the world in many respects in dealing with this issue. In many places, the resource managers are simply wringing their hands, not knowing what to do. And meanwhile, the reefs continue to be bleached. The management actions are going to depend on circumstances in a specific area. It's not a one-size-fits-all situation. This is a worldwide crisis, and things that work in the Caribbean or Great Reef aren't things that are going to work here. So it's going to be important to tailor the management strategies to address local concerns.
protection is good, and clearly everything in that step is going to be important. What about some of the proactive regeneration techniques that we've heard about?
Yeah, we actually have a coral nursery at Anuenue Fisheries, which is off Sand Island, and we're growing corals that are hopefully going to be more resilient to bleaching. The science of outplanting corals is still very new, and very few projects have actually been successful, but we're trying those. We're doing what everyone is talking about doing and aggressively moving in that direction. In Kanyoi Bay, we recently did some things that I don't know anyone else is doing anywhere. We used the Super Sucker, actually, Nature Conservancy, DAR, and others collaborated on this project, but we used essentially a large vacuum cleaner to vacuum off the invasive algae on the patch reefs in Kanyoi. And then we grew sea urchins at our hatchery at Anuenue, hundreds of thousands of these sea urchins, and put them on the patch reefs so that they would munch down the algae that was left. And today, we're seeing those reefs clear of algae. Algae is the biggest problem, probably, with resiliency. Once the reefs are bleached, if they don't recover, it's natural that algae grows over the dead coral. This happens everywhere. And that prevents new coral polyps from settling on the coral. By the way, the reason that parrotfish are so important is because they have a habit of eating. They're scrapers or excavators when they eat. They actually take off the surface of the coral, dead coral, with algae and leave a denuded surface where new coral polyps can settle and grow. Of all the fish out there, those are the most important. And they're big, they eat lots of algae, and they're critically important in the health of reefs. This has been shown around the world. So I would expect our new rules are going to focus a lot on trying to protect the herbivore population.
And when do you expect parrotfish? I'm sorry, we're going to have to go in just a minute, but when do you expect that those rules might be released? And also, how will the progress on the plan be monitored?
Well, I'm guessing we'll be going forward with some rules this summer. There'll be informational meetings, of course, as they usually are. And we're going to be monitoring our reefs. We've been doing this for years. But that monitoring will continue. And keep our fingers crossed. It's not as bad as I made it sound. But if it's not this next summer, it's going to happen. The water's warming, and we need to do what we can to address the issue.
It's not sounding good, that's for sure. Thanks very much for the time today.
Thank you for calling.
Dr. Bruce Anderson is the administrator of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Division of Aquatic Resources. You can find a link to the Coral Bleaching Recovery Plan on our website and Facebook page, The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, if you've ever worn a fruit basket on your head, you're ready for our next guest. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a man who made his mark in Hawaii as both an artist and a political activist. He was from Molokai, born in 1950, who graduated from Oahu's St. Louis School. At St. Louis, he studied under Hawaiian cultural experts John and Kahanu Lake and began his journey to political activism. As he later said, "I came to Honolulu to get educated. Instead, I lost my innocence." He first came to public notice as a musician, playing slack key guitar, and singing in the traditional Hawaiian falsetto style. In the mid-1970s, he became part of the Protect Kaholawe Ohana, calling for an end to the bombing of the island that had been used as target practice by the U.S. Navy for decades. He took part in a 1977 occupation of the island and was lost at sea in March of that year. This morning, we're looking for his name. If you know it, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you'll get the prize.
Aloha, I'm Grant Miyashiro with the Ninja Monkeys. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
There are extroverts, and then there's Hula Rosie, the stage persona of jazz singer Dana Land, who doesn't hesitate to build an extravagant, bawdy, colorful, and altogether over-the-top performance that might remind you of Carmen Miranda, Mae West, and Bette Midler rolled into one. Her Tropical Review is coming to the Honolulu Museum of Art, and she's here in our studio. Hi, Dana. Thanks for coming in.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, you brought your other persona, this creature who lives inside you, with you, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, she actually lives in my closet.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's probably just as well.
I gotta keep this separation, you
yeah.
know? Yeah. But she's been kicking and screaming lately, telling me she really needs to get out and show the world who she is and what she can
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Who is she and what can she do?
Oh, Hula Rosie, her mission is to bring light, love, and levity to the uh-huh. world through comedy and entertainment.
Uh-huh.
And the way she would describe herself is she would say, well, if you take a little bit of a appeal from Carmen Miranda,
right.
Kappa Shmia from Bette Midler,
mm-hmm.
a little hop from Hilo Hattie,
mm-hmm.
and maybe pulled a kind scat from Ella Fitzgerald, you're sort of on track at that point.
Mm-hmm. Because a singer to reach an audience sort of has to do a little bit more than sing, yeah?
I think so. You know, so she's stepping up to the cause. She loves her audience.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever she performs, you know, engaging with her audience through sing-alongs and dance-alongs and just funny comedy is certainly part of the show.
In the world of jazz, people sometimes sort of hesitate to be funny and entertaining and, you know, inclusive. Don't
yeah.
you think?
Oh, yeah, I think there's, you know, that risk of being too serious about one's art or craft.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I love about Hula Rosie is that she's completely free to be and do the things that she wants to do, you know, without any sort of, you know, social manners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she never does anything to step on anybody's toes, of course. But, you know, she's who I would be if there was no social veneer and, you know, that limit of you know, being accepted,
mm-hmm.
if you will. She's okay about anything.
Audiences love to live through somebody who does the things that they wish they could do, don't you think?
Oh, sure. I think so.
I mean, that's something that we sort of want from performers, I think.
Yeah, either that or they just want to be taken away,
mm-hmm.
you know, for an hour or two. Yeah, I mean, everybody's different, so it's hard to generalize, but certainly there are those out there. Yeah.
What sort of led you to create this person, or to let this person out of your closet would be a better way to describe it?
It was an evolutionary process. Started with my mother's opera wig that she came into my room with and asked me if I wanted.
Uh-huh.
And it was this disheveled mat of brown curls. I said, Mom, what am I going to do with that? Oh, well, then I'll just throw it away. Well, don't do that, Mom. I'll stick it in my closet.
Uh-huh.
So a few years later, I pulled it out and put it on. And this, you know, this beingness just started to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gave me a pair of anatomically correct coconut bra that was a gift given to her by her funny girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
So I donned those and pretty soon this accent just started coming out of nowhere.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been doing Hula Rosie for about 20 years, you know, mostly up in Northern California where we were living.
Uh-huh.
I'd go to birthday parties and do roasts and toasts and pull up, you know, birthday victims and dress them up and show them quirky hula moves and then go into Princess Papuli Has Plenty Papaya and
uh-huh.
other tunes like that.
So the whole emphasis on fun, obviously, but also emphasis on a lot of audience participation, yeah?
Oh, definitely, yeah. You know, and just sort of bringing people into the fold. When I go out as Hula Rosie, it's interesting. I never, you know, am the one to go up initially. I wait for people to come up to Hula Rosie. And it's those people that usually have a spirit of play about them,
mm-hmm.
who are curious and interested and want to know a little bit more about this, you know, quirky, colorful character. And then I have a, you know, there's just this natural way of bringing them in and engaging with them in a way that I don't really feel I could do as Dana. You know, so I realized I had an opportunity to just sort of, you know, engage with people in a way that I don't see done that often.
Mm-hmm. As you said, spirit of play, which there's probably a spirit of play that lives inside everyone.
Yeah.
Frequently suppressed as we get older.
Absolutely.
And why yeah. do you think we do that?
Oh, gosh.
We don't want to feel ridiculous. We don't want to be thought of as being silly or trivial. Or...
Sure. You know, afraid of looking like a fool.
Yeah.
You know, or they did something funny and somebody put them down for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's unfortunate. I mean, you know, we're all playful, most of us, as kids, you mm-hmm. know, out on the playground and, you know, ring around the rosy and just being our free selves.
Yeah.
And then through life, you know, we get sort of hammered down, suppressed. Oh, you can't do that. Oh, no, you better be careful about that. You know, nobody's going to take you seriously. You know, so, you know, certainly there's a time to be serious depending on what your career is.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's also important to find that child within and have some fun and go run on the beach. I still do cartwheels on the beach. I get out there. You know, it's just important, I think, to somehow look for ways to stay young and stay connected to that child within us.
When you see kids playing a game like that, their concentration is total.
Yeah.
And they're having so much fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's you really reflect on that. That's a lot to lose later in life.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people who find it through, you know, being creative mm-hmm. in the arts or cooking or, you know, I mean, there's many, many ways people can stay connected to that total concentration that is almost meditative,
mm-hmm.
you know, takes them away from all the other yammy yammies of life, you know, which can get to be too much. So, you know, I mean, I found music, you know, really at the age of 40. I was middle-aged. Even though I had grown up with piano lessons, I took my first voice lesson at 39, and I was performing professionally within a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought in a zillion years that would happen. You know, I just started with that first step, and I encourage others, you know, don't, you know, feel the pressure of having to find your passion. Just follow up something you're interested in. You know, maybe it's an art class. You know, doing this wine and art thing looks like so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or taking a dance class or something. You never know where it's going to lead you. You never know where you're going to find that joy, you know, joy of creation.
But you're definitely not going to find that joy unless you look for it.
Yeah, you know, just start with a curiosity. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Sure.
Makes sense. It'd be
yeah.
nice to...
Hula Rosie's all about that.
Well, you also have to recruit like-minded people for this enterprise, don't
Indeed.
You?
Indeed.
Not just Cabana Boys, but Cabana Boys are a big part of it, I would think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They are just like the cream, really, on the you know, the icing on the cake. But you're right. I mean, and I, you know, I sought out musicians who I knew had that spirit of play about them. Mike Lewis, hello, on trumpet. Rocky Holmes, you know, on woodwinds, Mark Lindbergh on drums, Ian Sheridan, who's a relatively new bass player from Seattle to the island. Yay. We need more bass players. And then Ethan Capone. I mean, really, just such a, they're all sweet, talented guys who are willing to go along this, you know, along this crazy ride with Hula Rosie.
Sounds like fun.
Well,
thanks so much,
that's
Dana.
The point. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Dana Land's Hula Rosie's Tropical Review will be performed Sunday, May 21st at 5 p.m. in the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art.
Come fly with me, come fly, let's fly away. If you could use some exotic booze at a bar in Far Bombay, come fly with me, come fly, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra, presenting West Side Story in concert, 7:30 p.m. this Saturday and 3 p.m. Sunday at Iao Theater. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org and mauionstage.com.
Medical cannabis has been legal in Hawaii for 17 years. 2 years ago, advocates applauded the passage of dispensary laws, so why aren't there any dispensaries open yet? Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider has today's reality check. Hey there.
Aloha, Bethan.
This is the big question that so many people have been asking for so long, thinking that, oh, it's just around the corner. But now we're hearing that really there could be one in July, maybe September, maybe who knows. Why?
Well, as you said, there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding this. And the problem is that as a new industry that the state is, you know, has never helped grow before, there's just been so many different delays along the way. And one of the biggest issues was how long it took the State Department of Health to negotiate a contract with a software company that was providing software that would help track marijuana from seed to sale. And, you know, that was only expected to take a few months, but in fact, it took nearly a year. And so companies that were already ready to start growing marijuana last August and September had to wait until February to do so. So that's really pushed the timeline back.
So basically, our lack of understanding really led to some expectations that couldn't be fulfilled. And of course, now we see this sort of snowballing. What happens now? How far along are some of these folks who would like to open their doors, and are they losing money in the process of not doing so?
Yes, the companies definitely are losing money. One company said they've lost, you know, conservatively hundreds of thousands of dollars as they've waited for that contract to be negotiated. They're hopeful that, you know, several companies are hopeful that they can open this summer. Others are hopeful that they can open this fall. But there are definitely some hurdles that still need to be overcome, namely the certification of labs where marijuana would get tested so you could see, you know, what's in it, make sure that there aren't harmful pesticides or other contaminants. And those labs, there are three labs that are in the process of trying to get certified, but that's when they're going to get certified is still up in the air. And the State Department of Health said at least one should get certified this summer if all goes well.
So that hopefully we don't have a repeat of the situation and ill-managed expectations. At the same time, is there a sense, though, that because there are so few dispensaries that competition is not going to be very keen, which means that people are going to be paying a lot for their medicine?
That's definitely a big concern. And the legislature this year actually passed a bill that would push back when the Department of Health could issue more licenses. The agency is supposed to be able to issue more licenses to companies to grow and sell marijuana this October. But the legislature wants the agency to hold off on another year for that. And that's concerning to advocates for patients and people who want to get into the industry who say that having an oligopoly, just eight companies managing the entire industry, really isn't fair to patients and won't provide them a variety of products or a variety of price points.
And so meanwhile, patients are just still stuck doing what they've been doing, which is to find it from caregivers or growing it themselves if they can. Well, I guess the story continues. We'll hear more about that saga if and when we actually see those dispensaries open. Thanks very much, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
Anita Hofschneider is a reporter with civilbeat.org, and every day we check in for a reality check. Now, attorneys pressing for answers about the president's second travel ban were back in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals today. The same question is at issue: is the executive order discrimination, or is it a matter of national security? In March, a federal judge in Hawaii stopped the ban just hours before it was scheduled to go into effect. Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin is on the line with us now from Seattle. Aloha.
Hi there.
So with what we have seen happen and the arguments this time around, they seem ostensibly the same as the first challenge, but the question is really going back to the president's intent, including his words external to the order itself. How was that issue framed today?
Yes. I can see that the judges were very thoroughly prepared, and they asked some really good questions of both sides. And it did boil down to two major issues, one of them that you already talked about, which was the whole point of how far can a president's powers go in order to protect national security. And they go far enough that they actually start discriminating against people based upon their nation of origin or based upon their religion. And we obviously said no, and that's the reason why we filed the lawsuit in the first place. But the other discussion that was coming up this week, which we anticipated, was that there was this question about, okay, so now we have this second executive order that President Trump's administration put out, and in many ways it cleaned up a lot of the truly offensive language that was in the first executive order. And what so the U.S. Department of Justice was arguing is that let's just stick with that, the words in the document, and not look behind it to find any discriminatory intent. We don't want to psychoanalyze the president. We don't want to be reading his mind or anything like that. And our response to that was, look, he said it so many times. I mean, just over and over again, even when he became president, he was still going on various channels and interviews talking about how this is a Muslim ban and how it's too bad that Muslim refugees get to come into the country all the time, which is really the same narrative that he said before. So we have some good questions on both sides about that.
How much does the fact that there is another challenge in the Fourth Circuit set up a synergistic effect between these two that might well mean that there's going to be a decision needed from the Supreme Court?
Exactly. What could happen is that the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit might come back with different opinions. In other words, the lower courts so far have banned, they've put an injunction on the travel ban. And so what could happen is, let's just say, for example, the Fourth Circuit, which is in Virginia, they could have decided on their issues in front of them. They could say that, look, we're going to strike down the injunction, and we're going to let the travel ban go forward. The Ninth Circuit, if it comes out with a decision, maybe about the same time, if they and we don't actually know, but whenever they do, if their decision could be, we're going to uphold the injunction. That would be the perfect recipe for the type of case that can and should go in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. When you have differing opinions from the lower circuits or the lower regions of the U.S., then the U.S. Supreme Court almost always steps in and just resolves it. The other possibility is that both courts could agree. They could uphold the injunctions that are in their various regions. And the U.S. Supreme Court could also just say, well, we're going to take a look at this because of it's so important to the nation's priorities and the nation's interests. This topic is so important, we want to talk about it. Or they could leave it alone. That's the other possibility, and some people are talking about how that might even be a path that the U.S. Supreme Court decided.
And, of course, there's no real timeline on any of this, so we're still stuck waiting and seeing when we get what decision and from whom. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the line from Seattle. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Beth.
Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin. Hawaii coffee growers have been battling a significant pest since it was first discovered in Kona in 2010. Earlier this year, the coffee berry borer turned up on Maui, and the state extended its quarantine, much to the chagrin of some Maui growers whose farms were still free of the beetle. Chris Manfredi is the director of the statewide Hawaii Coffee Association. We called him for an update on the status of coffee on the Big Island and throughout the state. And in just a few days, the Big Island will be celebrating the Kauai District Coffee Festival. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bethany.
So how well contained is the coffee berry borer now on the Big Line, on the Big Island? And on average, how much of the crop has to be written off?
Well, it's not contained at all. The quarantine helps manage the spread of it. But on the Big Island, it's virtually everywhere coffee is being grown. It's a fact of life all over the coffee-growing world, and now also true in Hawaii.
So how much of the crop feels the impact of this? How much is just unusable?
Well, it varies from farm to farm. We've gotten a lot of help from county, state, and federal officials to help battle the bug in terms of subsidies and education efforts, research on the part of university and federal researchers. It ranges anywhere from 2% loss to 100% loss, depending on how aggressive and how capable the particular farmer is in managing the pest.
So how are coffee farmers faring? And you mentioned that that's a huge range. You think about somebody losing their entire farm and crop to someone who may only lose 2% or 10% or even 20%.
Well, the 100% infestation is going to be a high extreme, and that would be a situation experienced either in wild coffee or in a farmer that's not really addressing the problem at all. Those are the exception. The average infestation level is somewhere around 10%. What the coffee berry borer problem has done is separate real farmers from some farmers that maybe were not real serious about farming.
And we've heard sort of rumors of that, of this has sort of been the defining line for a lot of farmers who are doing it really to produce a crop, and others who are doing it maybe perhaps more hobby oriented, or just letting it grow and seeing what happens. What about labor issues? Are there enough people out there to be employed to help combat the farm?
Well, labor shortages are making themselves even more known than in past seasons. Changes in climate have moved the coffee harvest in Kau to overlap more with coffee harvests in Kona. And the competition for labor last year was a major issue and continues to be. I'm hearing reports of as much as 20% of the crop was wasted for an inability to harvest it in a timely way.
Which is in particularly insulting when you think about the fact that you're already coping with the coffee berry borer. What about bringing in labor? Is that something that you're feeling frustration with?
Yeah, that is being done. Obviously, we have some concerns about changes in policy, and we're addressing those on the state, local, and federal level.
You're talking about being able to get visas for workers.
Yes. And also, the harvest labor issue also plays with the coffee berry borer problem, because if coffee is not harvested in the field and it's left on the ground or on the trees, those beans or cherries act as a reservoir for coffee berry borer, and they will emerge again in the following season. So one of the most important things a farmer can do to control coffee berry borer is field sanitation, getting the old berries out of the field so that the berry borer doesn't have anywhere to live.
But that's labor-intensive work, and if you don't have enough people to do it, as you say, you're just making a magnet for the coffee berry borer to find its way and to complete its inroads into another infestation. You were recently at the Global Specialty Coffee Expo in Seattle. How was Hawaii coffee regarded, and any change in the way that they were looking at Hawaii coffee?
Well, Hawaii coffee is among some of the finest coffees grown anywhere in the world. Hawaii coffee is also some of the most expensive coffee anywhere in the world, and part of that is due to the high cost of production. It's imperative that Hawaii produces some of the best coffees possible to be able to earn that price. We've done a very good new effort to, in my opinion, promote Hawaiian coffees to the world in a much more refined way. This year, the Hawaii Coffee Association, working with some contractors and designers, developed a new booth where we had essentially a coffee cafe on the show floor that was staffed by professional baristas, and we represented coffees from all around the state. All the coffees that were served in that booth were pre-judged by an independent cupping panel to ensure that we're serving Hawaii's best crop and representing Hawaii as a premium coffee growing origin.
Which may be
putting our best crop out there.
Yeah,
presenting it in a way that it ought to be presented.
But Chris, as you've been talking about, that may become even more difficult if you don't have enough coffee to be able to do it, because simply there's a want of labor and sanitation practices. Well, we wish you all the best and hope all things go well with the Ka'u Coffee Festival coming up. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Manfredi is the director of the statewide Hawaii Coffee Association. And again, the coffee festival, the Ka'u Coffee Festival, will be held from May 19th through the 28th.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Noah Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
It's Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our small planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. We've got him on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week's stargazers, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are still gracing us with their presence. Jupiter and Saturn can be seen right through till dawn, with Mars setting at around 8:28 p.m. The moon is waning this week, meaning that as we approach the weekend, we shall see a return of dark skies and great stargazing conditions here in the island.
And this week we are learning about new funding for a manned mission to a location in our solar system.
That's right. Recently on Stargazer, we reported that the new administration had slashed budgets for climate science and numerous interplanetary missions, including the amazing Asteroid Redirect mission. That particular mission would have seen us capture a small near-Earth asteroid and drag it into orbit around the moon. The mission itself would have tested new technology and given us invaluable experience that would pave the way for asteroid mining. However, thanks to those budget cuts, none of that is going to happen.
Yet we also know that there is a manned mission that just had its budget increased, and that's to go to Mars in 2030.
That is true, and President Trump himself has stated that he wants a Mars mission to happen soon. The reality, though, is a lot more sobering. Despite all the tough talk of make it happen, the reality of safe space travel is infinitely more complex.
And getting to Mars safely is not something we can do too easily, right? Because that's pretty much, as it stands, a one-way trip.
Absolutely. At the moment, it is. And space travel, as you know, is no joke. Getting humans safely into space and back again requires years of rigorous work. Humans need air, water, food, waste reclamation systems, and even an environment conducive to positive mental and physical health. These are all areas that we are still testing the water in, so to speak.
So it's not just a case of throwing money at the issue.
If only it were that simple. NASA still doesn't have a proven launch vehicle capable of long-distance interplanetary travel, let alone all the systems to safely take a team to Mars and back again. I would argue that issues such as climate science are far more important to us at this stage in the game. After all, Mars isn't exactly going anywhere, right?
One would think it's going to be there for some time, huh, Christopher?
One would hope.
Christopher Phillips and another insightful stargazer, thank you.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a key figure in the Hawaiian Renaissance, a musician and activist of the mid-1970s whose passionate effort to end the U.S. Navy's use of Kahoʻolawe as a practice site for bombers would lead to his death. Since 1941, the island had been used for bombing and strafing runs by Navy aircraft and was packed with military ordnance, some of it unexploded. It was off-limits to civilians, but the man we're thinking of today joined with eight others in an act of civil disobedience, an illegal occupation of the island in 1976 and 77. To protect Kahoʻolawe ʻohana would become a vital political component of the Hawaiian Renaissance, and he became one of its best-known spokesmen, speaking before the Hawaii legislature and reaching out to then-President Jimmy Carter. He also was a celebrated musician and is remembered as one of the greatest Hawaiian falsetto singers of all time. His name was George Helm.
And Nat Lau called us from Kaimuki, as did about 19 other people. We understand that the phone lines were blowing up, but Nat Lau was first and we'll get the prize. That's today's quiz. And if you've got one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
Animation all but rules the world of big-budget movies these days, opening up creative imaginations with a vast range of tools. Anything you can imagine, you can put on the screen, if you understand its techniques. The State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism's Creative Industries Division is sponsoring an ideation weekend on Maui next month, looking to bring about that merger between talent and technique. Georgia Skinner, Division Chief of Creative Industries, is on hand by phone to tell us more. Hi, Georgia.
Aloha. How are you?
Great All right.
to be with you today.
Good to hear your voice.
Thank
what's
you.
What's an ideation weekend?
Well, you know, it is kind of what it says. It's if you have an idea that mm-hmm. you believe would be a great online series or even a big budget movie that's animated, it's that germ of an idea that gets turned into something real. And so we're reaching out to our creative minds across the state, holding this workshop on Maui with some really stellar mentors, in fact, to help you get from idea to the project's fruition. And of course, animation is not a short process, but we feel that there's so much rich content out there ready to be developed. We want to help people get there.
So this is really open to anybody with a good idea who wants to follow through on it, is what it sounds like.
Exactly right, Chris. And I think the other important thing is we want them to protect their ideas before they come into the room, because this is what you want to do in the real business world of media and content today. So the workshop itself is really designed to be able to listen to people that have succeeded in this space and have them help you get to the next steps. 30 people total is what we're looking for, we're hoping to get. And the project is a long-term project of our Creative Industries Division. Creative Lab Hawaii also offers immersive programs and we'll be offering an immersive program in animation. These folks, we're hoping that we'll take the weekend. We'll be able to get into that in the future.
Well, how do you protect that idea, Georgia? Let's say I've got something that just exists as some noodles in the margin of a notebook, and how do I get that so that if it's good enough, I can keep it from being taken away from me?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Great question. So it's important to register either with the U.S. Copyright Office or the Writers Guild of America has a very simple process online. Provided that you have something you can scan and submit by email, it's a very easy process and a nominal fee to do so. This protects you in case anyone, mostly, you know, ideas are worth gold, and you want to protect yourself, and you want to make sure that you're making the first professional step in bringing this idea to life.
We're seeing big-budget movies that started out as, you know, YouTube videos, online series on a little website somewhere. I mean, it's anything can lead to a big-budget movie if it's good enough, as it seems to be today's climate.
That's true. And I think this is an environment that, again, is offered to people here in Hawaii that are interested in finding out how on earth do I take this idea, or even, let's say you have a great book, like children's books, for example. The market today for children's content online, Netflix is a great example, and two of our coaches actually are coming from the Netflix environment. They're developing content now for children on these cable service providers as opposed to just networks. So the market for material is still remaining very strong, and our key is to make sure that we provide access to Hawaii creators to be able to get that to market.
That's a big function, part of your function, isn't it, Georgia, just knowing examples of like what you just said, knowing where a market is.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we pride ourselves on trying to stay on the pulse of where things are going. And I think Hawaii content creators, in addition to the wonderful short films and feature films and narrative, as well as documentaries that have been developed from Hawaii, are significant. We want to test the bubble on the other side of the world in more interactive game development and in direct-to-web series, similar to, for example, Jeff Gill is one of our producers and writers who are coming to coach this session, and he just won an Emmy for his Netflix series, which he did with his partners from Jib Jab. And as many of us know, Jib Jab was a small phenomenon that grew into this amazing company online, and the show is called Ask the Story Bots. And so he's going to talk and break down for you, basically unpack how did this trajectory happen. And there's several other really great people, Karen Lee Brown and Andrew Robertson, who does Rescue Bots, which is part of the performers. So bots is a big word. Think of all the students out there that may have gone on to college that were successful in our robotics programs across the state. You know, how about creating a character for those robots and, you know, making that come to life? So, again, anyone with a storyline or idea, just we'd love to have you participate. It is a wealth of experience and knowledge packed into two full days on June 10th and 11th.
You know, Georgia, the media, some of the media you described wasn't even a blip on the horizon a generation ago.
Right. And so that's a content monster, too. All of it must be fed, and we want it to be fed with great content from Hawaii.
Well, feeding the monster is what we're all about, Georgia.
It's not a bad monster.
No.
It's a good one.
Well, yeah, people have such negative connotations about the term, but no, I agree with you. Thanks so much, Georgia.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You bet.
Aloha.
Georgia Skinner is the Division Chief for the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism's Creative Industries Division. Its Creative Lab Hawaii Animation Weekend will be held on Maui June 10th and 11th at the Maui Economic Development Board's Malcolm Training Center in Kihei. And the deadline to apply is June 2nd. There are a lot of different activities going on around the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, this is one close to my heart, Derek.
Yes, I know. You are a lover of film photography.
Actually shoot with film.
Yes. One of the okay. Tomorrow. And, yeah, like I said, lovers of film photography will be interested in this event. It's at Treehouse in Kaka'ako, and they host a film photo swap meetup pauhana from 5 to 8 p.m., taking place at the Village Bottle Shop, which is next to Treehouse. So bring your prints, color, black and white, 4x6, 5x7, 8x10, instant silver gelatin, whatever. You know all what I'm talking about.
I do.
Right? All these terms. Swap with other film photographers, hang out, talk about gear, and shoot after. And all that's required are photos taken on film and a love of film photography, which we have discussed that you have, Chris. It's at Treehouse in Kaka'ako, 675 Awahi Street, from 5 to 8 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
Well, let's keep film alive, Derek.
Yes.
And on the Big Island, it's a chance to audition for a summer musical.
Mm-hmm. Kilauea Drama and Entertainment Network announces auditions for Finian's Rainbow. Auditions will be held on Tuesday and Wednesday at Kilauea Military Camp's Kilauea Theater, beginning at 6:30. There are parts for all ages, as well as non-singing roles, and primary roles include Finian, his daughter Sharon, and more. Of these auditions are Tuesday and Wednesday at Kilauea Military Camp's Kilauea Theater, starting at 6:30 p.m.
And that's a great show, too, Derek. I've seen a production of it. I love that show.
Oh.
Sounds like fun.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thanks very much for joining us today. We hope you'll come back tomorrow. On the agenda is how Maui parks and golf courses are going pesticide free. West in Maui's Dwayne Sparkman talks resort landscape management.
And the music of Kenny Endo's contemporary ensemble, the Kahilu Quintet.
You can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org if you have something to say, or you can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can get to me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you tomorrow for more of The Conversation.